Grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Registration is not required and individuals can join at any time. For more information, call 384-5829 or www.livingyogacenter.net. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Champaign Park District, presenting the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra on Monday, October 11th at 7:30 p.m. at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. Ticket information is available at 356-9063 or online at thevirginia.org.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Just a quick mention that tomorrow morning on the program, Doyle Moore will be here, the man we like to call our chef in residence. It is always fun when he stops by, and for a long time we've been doing a show with him the first Wednesday of the month to talk about cooking. And it's just something we do because it's fun and we enjoy it, and that'll be tomorrow. Also tomorrow we'll be talking about Mexico, reviewing a little bit of its very long history and talking about the important connections between Mexico and the United States. And our guest for the show will be Earl Shores. He's a journalist, lecturer, novelist. He has a new book out that's titled The Life and Times of Mexico. And we'll be talking about that tomorrow. Also, he wrote a book a number of years ago. We did actually talk about it on this program that was about Latino Americans. And I'm sure that he'll have some things to say about Latinos and American politics and maybe specifically about the election that we're headed into right now. So that's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about poetry, and our guest for the program is poet Bob Hickok. He is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He will be giving a reading this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore. This is in the Author's Corner. It will take place at 4:30. He has published a number of collections of his work and has gotten a number of awards and a lot of recognition. He's published in Poetry, Paris Review, The New Yorker. He's the author of The Legend of Light, a book that won a collection that won the Felix Pollack Prize in Poetry. Also, Animal Soul, which was finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. His newest collection is titled Insomnia Diary, and it's published by University of Pittsburgh Press. He's now teaching creative writing at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, and didn't really start out to be a poet, but was very interested in writing. He, in fact, worked for a number of years in the auto industry, and wrote poetry kind of in his spare time, and did it, he says, not because anybody encouraged him to do it, but because he just felt it was in him to do it. And his work got more and more favorable attention, was published, and now he's made the transition to perhaps being a poet full-time and also being a teacher of writing. And we're glad to have him here on the program. Questions are welcome. Certainly, if somebody would want to call in and talk with him, you can do that. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. Also, we have toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. I'm just sitting here telling Bob Hickok that I'm just back here after having been away for about 2.5 weeks, and I'm not sure I remember how to do this anymore.
It's good to forget sometimes.
Yes, that's good. I try to, at least for those few times I get away, to try to get away as far as I possibly can, although somehow the show always haunts me. I can't quite get away from it.
Where did you go?
Canada. I was in Atlantic Canada. It's a place my wife and I, there's this island in the Bay of Fundy, which is pretty much just a rock surrounded by the Atlantic Ocean that we like very much and that we keep going back to because it's about as different from here as you can get. It's a long way away. It's very peaceful. It's very quiet. You can sit there and stare at the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah. If that's all you want to do, it's great. It's one of those little places that time forgot. There's a main road that runs all the way down one side of the island from the north to the south. There's no stop sign. There's no stoplight. There are no stoplights on this place.
That's great.
And it's, yes, although it's now more and more over time, it seems to have been discovered, and I'm sort of concerned about that. There has been a lot of, over the last year, there seems to be a number of new places built on the island, and the islanders tell us that it's Americans. the main coast is too crowded for people now, so they're looking for other places that are like that. So
that's always the dilemma with places that you like. You want to talk about them.
I know, and that's actually I'm sure my wife would say, no, shh, don't tell anybody about this place.
Don't talk about it on the radio.
But I think it's too late. I think it's been discovered, so all we can hope is that it won't change very much. I don't think it's ever going to be a really... No one's going to go build a high-rise hotel on this rock.
Or a Starbucks.
No, I don't think that that's ever going to happen. Well, anyway, it's glad to have you here.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So before you you started being a teacher of writing and more being a poet, tell me about what it is that you did. You were working in the industry that made machines that made parts for cars. Is
close.
That kind of right?
I designed automotive dies. You know the term tool and die?
Right.
I designed large objects that stamp out car parts.
Okay.
So I didn't actually make them. I sat, for the most part, at a computer and designed what someone else would then build, and it would go into a stamping plant.
Yeah. And did your dad also work in the industry?
He did. He built dies. His background was as a toolmaker. Very successful at it from an early age. Became a manager, I think at 24, he ran his first plant. And when I was younger, I wanted to do what he did, and it was the only time he ever said no. His feeling was that the chance of someone making a living doing that kind of work was very small, that the industry was changing enough. He says, no, you can't go into that. I ended up coming into a different phase of the business, and his estimate was right. By and large, that kind of work is leaving this country. Mm-hmm. That kind of skilled labor is disappearing. You probably had some of that in this area, but much more up in Chicago and certainly in Michigan. Yeah. A lot of tool and die shops.
Well, you did put some time in the college classroom studying other things, not engineering or design.
Yes and no. I'm one of those people who had kind of a weird educational history. I think I have 124 undergraduate credits and no degree. I went to probably easiest thing to refer to it is as an experimental school. No grades, you got evaluations. People did very well coming out of that school, going into graduate schools, but they reorganized the college when I was finishing up and said I had to take things like algebra, which I had done a long time ago, and I was not interested in that. But I got into a graduate program in library science with the understanding that I would finish my undergrad work. Mm-hmm. Quickly realized I didn't want to be a librarian, so I just let all that go. And that's when I started doing the design work.
And you did well enough to have your own company.
I did. It turned out I just had the skills that you need to do that kind of work. And toward the end of my career, I started my own company, which was a lot of fun. I had never given any thought to owning a company. Mm-hmm. I'm not entrepreneurial in that way. But I liked working. I liked having my own people and trying to run a company the way that I always wanted to see someone do it.
So you said your dad discouraged you from doing this because he figured you couldn't make a living at it. Well,
the build end.
Yeah. What's his thoughts about your being a poet?
They became more comfortable with that as it became apparent that I could generate money. These are Depression-era folks. My dad was born in 30. My mom was born in 32. And they, particularly on my dad's side, they saw a lot of desperation. His father would hitchhike back and forth across Michigan looking for work. So what you do for a living is something, in his mind, that you really have to depend on, and the arts are a luxury. Mm-hmm. You'll see this in generations. One generation, you know, it may be a stone cutter, and the next generation, because there's a kind of economic loam that the family grows out of, is afforded opportunities that the previous generation wasn't. But as I started earning money, winning awards, and now with the teaching job, their attitude changed markedly about about doing this.
Yeah. Well, there we talked a little bit about one part of your life. How did you start writing poetry?
Girlfriend broke up with me. I was...
was born of deep emotional pain.
Yeah. Very, very hackneyed stuff. I was driving around listening to rock and screaming, crying, whatever, pulled over at a drugstore and got a notebook and started writing things and found I really liked it and kept going.
And you never had any kind of formal education in writing?
No.
Per se?
No. I had a couple, I think one or two courses in college. One was on writing articles. And I think I took a creative writing class in college, but that was it. Hmm. Found some people there that would look at poems, and that was very helpful.
Well, there, ladies and gentlemen, is the brief biography of our guest, Bob Hickok. He's a poet. He's here visiting the campus to do reading, and I expect he's also spending time talking with students here who are writers.
Yes.
His most recent collection is Insomnia Diary. And without going any further, I think I'd like to ask you to read something.
Sure.
For us. Could be of your choice. I know there are a lot of poems in here that I really like very much, but it could be whatever you would like to do.
Sure. Well, since we've been talking about work, I'll read a poem that has to do with having to lay someone off.
Oh, yeah.
If I can find it. This, one of the things I didn't like about owning a business was when things got to the point that I had to one of the expressions people use is let people go. I had to lay a guy off who, very nice guy, has 5 kids. This poem is about that. It's called Dropping the Euphemism. He has 5 children. I'm Papa to 100 pencils. I bought the chair he sat in from a book of chairs, staplers, and spikes that let me play Vlad the Impaler with invading memos. When I said, I have to lay you off, a parallel universe was born in his face, one where flesh is a loose shirt taken to the river and beaten against rocks. Just by opening my mouth, I destroyed his faith. He's a man who can think honey-glazed ham and act out the thought with plastic or bills. We sat. I stared at my hands. He stared at the wall, staring at my hands. I said other things about the excellent work he'd done and the cycles of business, which are like the roller coaster thoughts of an oscilloscope. All this time, I saw the eyes of his wife, which had always been brown like almonds, but were now brown like the crust of bread. We walked to the door. I shook his hand, felt the bones pretending to be strong. On his way home, there was a happy song, because Desaad invented radio. The window was open. He saw delphinium, but couldn't remember the name. I can only guess. Maybe at each exit that could have led his body to Tempe, to Mars, he was tempted to forget his basketball team of sons, or that he ever liked helping his wife clean carrots, the silver sink turning orange. Running's natural to most animals who aren't part of a lecture series on nature's dead ends. When I told him, I saw he was looking for a place in his brain to hide his brain. I tried that later with beer. It worked until I stood at the toilet to make my little waterfall and thought of him pushing back from a bar to go make the same noise.
Hmm. It's Bob Hickok reading one of the poems in his collection, most recent collection, Insomnia Diary. So this was this poem, in fact, inspired by your personal experience having done that?
This one was.
This one was.
Yeah. The poem that follows it is fictional. In that poem, I get to call him back from being laid off. But, yeah.
I know. I apologize for the goofball question, because I'm sure people do this all the time. All poets get this. People ask them, where do the poems come from?
Right.
Where do the ideas come from? For you, is there some way to answer that question? Where the seeds come from that eventually become poems?
I think there is. I think that's easier to get at than it often seems, but it's usually best to talk about it through the individual poems, to talk about how certain poems happened. Probably one of the most common things for me would be something that I saw someone do, or some moment that I've lived through or watched others go through. It's usually something about people that gets me going. Or some odd fact that I'll read. There's something I read recently in National Geographic in the work they're doing to determine what's going on with the climate changes. One of the things they look at are the middens of pack rats, the stuff that they collected over time. When they crack into that and analyze the seeds and things that they'll find from other times, that get information about how weather was before. There's something about that. Just the particularness fascinates me. The notion that someone would find value in looking at this, or that they would ever have the idea of investigating a kind of trash heap, just fascinates me, and that will probably become a poem.
In a deliberate sort of way, have this idea that you would like to write things that are about issues, or is it just that just happens to be the way your mind goes, and that's what you're inclined to do, and you're just doing that because that's what you do, and not so much because you say, okay, I don't want to sit down and I don't want to write a poem about global warming.
Right. I was thinking about that the other day. I find I'm very drawn to getting into things, to issues. But certainly as I've aged, it happens much more organically. I don't set out to do it, but it ends up coming up. I finally was able to – it's the wrong way to put it. I ended up writing a poem recently about the towers coming down. Had not set out to do it. I was in a small plane, and it occurred to me that this plane was not going to be flown into a building. Mm-hmm. And just that, the oddity of that realization allowed me to write about what had happened in a way that I was very happy with. Whereas if I would have sat down thinking, okay, I must now write a poem about the towers coming down, by and large, that kind of thing, it certainly doesn't work for me, and I think most of us end up dealing with more cliches when we do that. You're coming in with too set a notion of what it is that's going to happen.
I have this right that I read something about how you don't like to do a lot of revising?
Yes and no. I prefer to revise as I go. I tend not to write beyond what I'm happy with, what's working. So I rewrite many times as I'm sitting there. I certainly do revise. I certainly do come back to poems. But by and large, if they don't hit a kind of critical mass in the initial attempt, I probably won't be coming back to them. I remember years ago hearing something that John Lennon said. I was never a big fan of his music, but I always liked this comment. His feeling was that he should complete a song in one go, and that if he didn't, it was too hard to get back to the mood, the mindset, the perspective that he had while he was doing that. And I find with poetry that's very true. That for me, it's so much about capturing how I feel in a given moment that if there isn't enough of a record of that moment, then I'm coming back to a void.
Yeah.
So.
our guest, Bob Hickok. And again, we're talking with him about some of his writing. He has published several collections. The most recent is Insomnia Diary. It's published by University of Pittsburgh Press. You certainly should be able to find it. And also, you can, in fact, hear more from him, could meet him, if you stop by the Author's Corner at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30. He'll be doing a reading. Of course, anybody who is like to call in here, maybe talk with him, you can do that. 333-9455, toll 3-800-222-9455. There's another poem I'd like you to read. I'm not sure what the title is. What's the one with you looking at your butt in the mirror?
Mortal Shower.
Mortal Shower. Okay, I like that a lot. It's a personal poem, but it's probably one where maybe some other people had that. I can't find it. I liked it a lot. And, of course, there's a lot of poems in here that I really do like. So, there it is. Okay. And page number 62, where you could read that. I don't know. Is there any bad language in here we can't say on the radio?
That's the hard thing for me with this stuff. I generally forget. And I've had instances on the radio where I come across a word and I just have to leave it out.
Mm.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. Yeah, let's do that one for us.
This is called Mortal Shower. I met my butt in a Pittsburgh hotel room. My face still looks like my face, but not my butt. My hair no longer resembles an ad for Jell-O pudding. People thought it was chocolate pudding for years, so thick and rich. There was fog in the bathroom, and then not fog. I faced my face, and then not my face. The mirror staring at my butt winked at the mirror staring at my face. And the future was defined as an effort to use the word sag in my resume. Have sagged, will sag, am looking for a position in which to maximize my sagging potential. I once cared what went on back there, about the extent of grip and rise, just as some birds crave the reddest plumage. And I propositioned mirrors, watched women's eyes follow, turned in shop windows to see if my pants fit their purpose. Then love and car payments. Love and the sofa needs to be moved. Love and her grandmother dies. My grandmother dies. Love and she comes home and I'm thrilled by her coat and voice and the brown habit of her eyes. She likes my butt and lies about its travels, how it's lost focus. And there are waddles to come. Please God, if dentures only partials. May depends be cheap in bulk and the earth generous with its telepathy. I'm in Pittsburgh tonight and with her. Mirrors don't scare me. Room service is a gas because she's alive. I'm a giant, a tight-ass titan because she's alive and says, come home. The Honda needs new brakes. A robin flew into the window today but shook it off, just dizzy, stunned by reflection.
I like that poem very much. I like it for many reasons, I guess. Because it's funny, because it's true, because it's a love poem, and it says something about just how important it is the people in our lives who love us are to our staying sane, and I also like the image of the bird flying into the window, because how many times every day do we do that? Do we smack into something, and if we're really lucky, we just say ugh, okay, and we shake it off and we go on. I mean, it seems like in a lot of ways life seems to be just a long series of smacking into windows.
Yeah. As I was being driven over here, I was told about the fellow who brought me here. As he was opening his car door today, a bicyclist came up, hit the door, went over the door, popped right up, came up to him. He actually seemed more concerned about him than himself. And it's like you say, we are always smacking into things.
Mm-hmm. Was this in fact another true moment? This did actually happen like that?
No, not quite. Not quite. It's that poem is an excuse to talk about missing Eve. It came out of going away and doing readings. And initially I found that very hard. I like being home. And it took me a while to get used to being away. And I think the stuff that's in that poem is largely there to allow me to say that, you know, that it, just how hard it was to be away.
Yeah.
But the other, oftentimes you'll end up lying about something, saying you have gone through it when you haven't, although you know in another way you have. I mean, I've lost my hair, which is a similar kind of thing to looking in the mirror and seeing which way your body is going. I liked getting it aging through that image.
Well, I'm sure that again, one of these things that all writers sort of have to deal with, because people are always sort of throwing them at them, is the idea that everything they write about must right. be about them, or they have or it has happened to them, or they've experienced it. It's not just that they sort of dreamed it up as a way of talking about something that they really do think about,
right?
But that whatever that event is, they obviously assume, well, this was a true event. It happened pretty much like that, and it happened to you, didn't
right.
it? Well, yeah, maybe yes, and maybe not.
I think that's particularly the case with poets. There is, I think, with poets, a greater expectation that we're somehow speaking our soul. And that if that's the case, it has to be something you've lived. It has to be literally true. And yet I think a lot of poets end up making up a great deal of what they write, not in spirit. I think in spirit, when you start lying about the spirit of these things, you've gone wrong. But a great deal of it is manufactured. I'm finding as I talk to fiction writers more that they're more inclined to write out of their lives more directly. Hmm. And their imagination, it's not to denigrate that at all. I just think it's a feature of how much ground they have to cover versus what a poet has to cover. There's just a poem will contain far less than a story or a novel.
Yeah.
And it's much easier for us then to just decide that this is the way it was.
I read a little article about you where you said, in regards to writing, that you felt that nobody had really pushed you to write, nobody had really encouraged you to write. You didn't really have examples, but that you felt that it was just in you to do. Why though poetry, and why not a novel or a short
right.
stories or some other form?
I don't know. It's something that I think about periodically. Certainly part of the reason is because I was no good at song lyrics. I think I would love to be a musician, but I did not have that in me. There's something about a certain kind of repetition and concision that they have that I didn't find I could stop myself in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know. I have started writing short stories in the past year, and I like that a great deal. But it does not feel like it will become the main thing that I do. I think what I like about poetry is it feels absolutely wide open, that you can write a poem about anything. And I think it's the case with the other genres. But the way that you can jump from idea to idea in poetry, or feeling, thought, image to image, without a lot of connective tissue is very appealing to me.
Hmm.
I like that kind of associative movement, and it's harder to achieve, I think, in the other forms. At a certain point, I think it's just chance. And if you have a certain level of enjoyment and then success, why would you not keep doing the thing? But it very well could have happened that I started with a different form and that went well too.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the breakup where it all started. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about how you hadn't, at least at the beginning, hadn't had any formal training in writing. So now doing more writing and working with people who want to be writers, have you made any more kind of a deliberate attempt to either to teach yourself, to look at the writing of other poets that either you like or you don't or whatever, and look at other people's work and try to take it apart and think, oh, now how does this work and why did they do this? And in a sense, you know, school yourself on other people's work the way no doubt you do with your students.
Absolutely. Personally, reading others, the work of others, the way it influences me most is it will make me feel lazy. When I encounter a poem or poems that I really like, that I admire, and particularly where they're doing something that I just feel I cannot do, it's a kick in the butt, and I like having that kind of work around. The teaching has been fascinating in that I've had to make myself be articulate about things which I never thought I could or would be articulate, the kind of analysis you're talking about where you break things down and you try to flesh out why something is working. The inclination most of us have, I think, particularly when you come from the creative writing side, is to not go too far beyond liking or disliking something. And I find with students it's very easy to push them to at least make one more statement beyond what they might be inclined to do. And once they get that habit of pushing beyond where they think their mind stops, in a sense, they can keep going, and it carries over into their own work. I think that's the real benefit of analyzing other people's works at work. It's not necessarily that you will pick up a particular trait, a particular ability with image or a way of constructing a metaphor. Analyzing other people's work is very creative, and it's another way that you can feel strong about your ability to create something, and I think that carries over when you're doing your own work.
We have a caller here. We're going to get to. Let me, just for the benefit of other folks, introduce again our guest here in this part of Focus 580, poet Bob Hickok. He's here visiting the campus to talk about writing with some students here. He's going to be doing a reading in the Author's Corner. This is at the Illini Union Bookstore at 4:30. He's published a number of collections of his work. His most recent is Insomnia Diary, published by University of Pittsburgh Press. He was 2002 National Book Critics Circle Award finalist for a collection titled Animal Soul. The Legend of Light was named an ALA Book List Notable Book of the Year in 97. He's won back-to-back Pushcart Prizes, the Felix Pollack Prize in Poetry. He now teaches creative writing at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And here's caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I saw an article about you last night in our local paper, the News Gazette, and liked the poem that they had in there about losing hair. I liked the image. And I think you're writing about some interesting things and being very honest about it.
Well, thank you.
And
although I'd rather have my hair.
Well, I married a guy who was, people thought he was my father when we got married, who didn't know him, and I'm actually a few months older than he is, because his hair line was receding, and he's not completely bald, but he doesn't have much hair. I like it, actually.
Good.
It looks distinctive.
Good.
And besides, who wants, you know, a guy who just looks like a magazine cover? I mean, you can look at a magazine cover if you want to. I want somebody with some character and something underneath that that's got some steel and grit and an interesting look on life. Anyway, I was wondering whether, and I can't find the doggone newspaper. I put it aside and it's gotten buried underneath the chaos here. Is that poem in the Insomniac's diary?
In fact, and maybe you weren't listening earlier in the show, he read it.
He did it. Okay, good. Yeah. And that one's in that particular collection?
Yes.
And the butt one is in that collection.
Yes. Yes. That's the same. That was an excerpt from that same poem.
No, actually, the poem she's talking about is a different one.
Oh, I thought it was the. I thought it was part of that same poem.
I don't know if it's in that book or not.
Well, see, there you go. You should not pay attention to anything I say.
Well, you know, you got a complicated job there. I couldn't do it. It's quite an amazing juggling job you do. Okay, well, I'm almost inclined to see if I can rearrange my life and come listen to you and maybe buy a copy or two of your book for gifts. Thanks a bunch.
What's your name?
Thanks.
I'd rather not say.
We generally don't ask people
you
to.
You don't do it. Okay.
We don't. Just people told us they appreciated it. That's just that level of anonymity, so we don't ask people to.
If I manage to make it there, I'll introduce myself.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks.
Well, thanks for the call. And indeed, other questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. See, somehow I thought that was part of that poem.
It sort of is. I talk about my hair briefly in that poem.
Oh, maybe that was another one of those hair references. It shows how deeply it affected
you. I'm glad that phase of my writing is over.
You got that, got that out of your system?
Out of my system.
Okay, good. Well, how about reading something else?
All right.
I don't know. Again, you could
let me see if
choose.
That one is in here. Oh, it is. I will read that one.
Good.
It has the very clever title of The Bald Truth. My hair went on a diet of its own accord. Rogaine is the extent of my vanity. It didn't work, but it was fun treating my head with fertilizer as if it were a phrenologist's lawn. They were on to something in believing the skull you have is the soul you are, that the brain is involved in the sport of tectonics. My skull has a fault line like California's, which makes sense given how the hemispheres of my brain collide. The right side wants to clean the house, while the left knows dancing is the best part of who we are. Or vice versa. I always have to look that up. They say baldness means energetic things about parts of me that aren't falling off. The real compensations, having no choice meeting the mirror, but to accept that tomorrow will be different from today. In greeting my wife, not wondering, as pretty men must, if I'm kissed for my soul or face, to never doubt, as I become invisible, that I'm seen by love.
All right. And then again, that and the other poems that Bob has read this morning, they are all in the book Insomnia Diary. And it's the newest one, so out there if you're interested. I've been fortunate in doing this program over the past few years to talk with some poets, people who like you, who came here to read. And even though I read a lot, I have to confess that's really the only time that I end up reading poetry is when I'm going to be talking with somebody about their work. And probably, I imagine almost every time I talk to a poet, I no doubt ask the same question about why it is that you think that, we are told that the number of people who read regularly is small.
Down.
And then you look at the number of the audience for poetry. It's even less. I mean, why do you think that there isn't more interest, there isn't more sort of respect for it, that people just don't, even people who read, a lot of people who read don't read poetry?
Mm-hmm. Two things come to mind. Number one is there is a strain of anti-intellectualism in this country. Beautifully so, maddeningly so. We are so focused on achievement, on doing, on forward motion. We've never been a people that is that fond of deliberation. And reading is inherently a deliberative, quiet act. Mm. The other thing is that I think at some point poets almost completely turn their back on readers. I understand the more I write why you become interested in a kind of minutia, just as anyone who does anything for a long time and develops a certain level of skill can absolutely be geeked by the tiniest little nuance. Mm-hmm. And you want to talk to other people who do that thing. They are the only people who, by and large, will get the finer points. But somehow in going deeper into our writing, we substantially gave up talking to, for lack of a better term, a lay audience. So I think I tend to split the difference. I think there is something in the American spirit that is hostile to reading and is hostile in particular to poetry. But poets bear a lot of responsibility for this. I don't think we're trying. I know substantially people are not trying to speak to folks who don't write. We know. Poets talk about this all the time. We know our audience is other poets. And in trying to achieve whatever it is we're trying to achieve, we tend to write for those poets because they're also our readers. It seems like a huge mistake to me to go too far down that road or to only go down that road.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of the people I've talked to have talked to about their work and have read it, and they have read it. And I am certainly not a poet or a writer of any kind. But again and again, I guess I have found myself totally knocked out by what I'm hearing. Just really, really fine stuff. Certainly accessible, very powerful. You know, the idea of poetry is that what you're taking, you're trying to just sort of distill something down to its real bare essence, you know, and can be terrifically, terrifically potent and powerful and have a lot of beautiful images in it. I'm sure that I have encountered other kind of work, and what I've read it and I've thought, what?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, and I would say to the poet, I'm sorry, but I just don't get this. Can you explain it to me? And it's always nice to have some backstory, be able to talk to the person. But you know, certainly there's plenty of work, and I have encountered it that I think it stands fairly well, its own.
Right.
You don't need to have the person who wrote it explain to you what it means.
I would like to see writers, poets doing both. I have my what work that I could not explain it. There's something about the sound, the images that hang together that I find appealing, a certain kind of momentum. And then there's other work which is absolutely crystal clear. It disappoints me that poets aren't working with the range that we have. And some people do, but by and large we tend to find a group and we stick with that group. If you want to be very accessible, that's pretty much all you're going to do. If you're more inclined to be mysterious, that's what you're going to do. And I like moving around. One of the mistakes, I think, is to read the wrong kind of work in the wrong context. And I think making those kind of decisions alone can be very helpful to building more of an audience for poetry.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit less. I have a caller here. I want to make sure I get in. Kankakee, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning and welcome back to Illinois, David.
Oh, thank you.
Here's another caller who I'll also complimenting the excellent work of Jack Brighton in your absence is happy to have you back. And good morning, guest Bob Hickok.
Good morning.
Any questions? Do you write a journal?
No, I do not. I've never been one to do that.
In addition to your nonfiction poetry, do you also write other nonfiction?
No. I find that my mind, it just does not seem suited to essays. I would love to be able to write something like that.
And could you tell us more about what made you a poet? Thank you.
You're welcome. Again, it's very difficult for me to articulate why it is that I find myself doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cliche. It's one of the things you will hear artists say, that whatever it is that they do, it just seems to be something that they had to do. I am much happier when I write. Besides spending time with Eve, there's nothing I want to do more than write. That's about all I can say about it.
Other questions are welcome. Someone wanted to call in. And I, again, I'd like to just, you know, do at least one more. Is there something else that you'd like to
Yeah, there's one. Read? There's one that I'd like to read. This poem comes from a moment where I was walking back from class and I ran into a student I'd had the previous semester. Where I teach, we have the ROTC, and she's in the Corps. And she had just heard news that a former Corps member had been killed in Iraq, and it made her realize that the likelihood was that she would be going over when she graduated. Hmm. The poem is called ROTC. The edges of leaves were turning brown, and sweaters had come out of hiding. Red ones and orange, premonitions of the flames of the season. I was entering the archway, green bag over my shoulder. I had legs and such, hands, the expected gear, a bit of happiness thanks to the sun and the approach of dinner. Chow at Cinco de Mayo or the cellar maybe, the waitress with gluttonous skin, tattooed with griffins and everywhere, eyelids, elbows, under construction, just above her ass. I felt a bit of helium in my blood, sensation of rising. The week's last class had been full of sparrows. They flew through the poems. They sang. I was entering the archway. She was in fatigues, my student of two semesters ago, from Queens and training for tanks. Was dressed in a mess of olive and gray to hide the body, the kill. She usually said hi like a bottle rocket, but that day her voice was dirt, had flesh in it. A boy man from the Corps had been shelled in Iraq. She'd met him, she said. Touched him, she said. They shook hands, had a drink. She'd noticed a stutter, slight, still smelled Glenlivet and Old Spice. She smiled at this perfumery, the high and low of it, said it was likely she'd go and then nothing. I watched the hawks of her eyes trying to escape and thought of putting a hand on her shoulder too late, after I'd turned and the years of seconds had passed. Coming out of the archway into a downpour of sun, a frisbee spun red through the air. Students hived about the paths and lawns, hyper in speech and curling toward each other like sex. But it had turned winter in me, and only ice has remained.
Mm-hmm. I tell you, I have another caller here. I want to make sure we get that person, and then maybe I'll ask what I was just what's just on my mind there. Edgar County, line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you. I have always loved poetry, and unlike David, who has other things to do, I can read poetry. But yet at the same time, I write poetry, and I'll never share it with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know whether it's too personal or what it is, or else I'm intimidated for the fact that since I majored in the most practical of things, in undergraduate school interpretation, where you get up and read
right.
poetry, and, you know, met Auden and Frost and
wow.
and Stephen Spender and, you know, Robert Penn Warren, all these people.
What is the Spender poem?
Pardon?
What is the Spender poem? The waving, not drowning?
What, Stephen Spender?
Is that him?
Yes, right.
Yeah.
You know, he was of the English.
Right.
You know, the most boring man I ever had lunch with. I mean, he just sat there and stared.
Oh.
And you'd ask a question, and he would give you a very short response. Now, Auden was much different in that I met him on a Sunday in St. Louis, and his major emphasis was the fact that, that he was really ticked off about the blue laws in St. Louis on Sunday. But yet at the same time, that man was so far ahead of him, of his generation in poetry, and things that he wrote in the 20s and the 30s, which became fact in the 40s and the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he, and then I knew him when I was in New York before he moved to England because he didn't like the crime in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he lived at St. Mark's Place in the Lower East Side, so what can you expect? But yet at the same time, 2 weeks after he moved to England, he was robbed. So, but I was intimidated by these people, even though I knew some of them, you know, on a personal basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so thus, I compliment you for being able to publish.
Well, thank you.
But who were your, the people who you like as poets?
It changes over time. I wrote for quite a while before I started reading much. I tend to talk about people I'm reading at the moment. One person I'm really taken with right now is a Greek poet named Yannis Ritsos. I find his work fascinating. He had a lot of personal trouble relating to World War II and some of the turmoil in Greece. But it truly changes all the time, the people that I'm reading.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies to both caller and to Bob, but we've exhausted our time, and we're going to have to stop. For people who are interested in hearing more from our guest, Bob Hickok, however, he will be doing a reading on the U of I campus at the Illini Union Bookstore at the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30. He's published several collections of his work. The most recent is Insomnia Diary, from the University of Pittsburgh Press. Bob is teaching now creative writing at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
It was fun.
The program today, made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work dress and sport shoes, Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Support also comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, for over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. And that's about it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine, back again as host, ladies and gentlemen, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. It's good to be back. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, the American West and the Rocky Mountains will feature an archive interview about the place they hold in our history and in our imagination. We'll rebroadcast an interview with naturalist and writer Gary Ferguson. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. December wheat, 305, that up 2.5. March wheat, 316 and 3/4, up 2. December corn, 205 and a quarter, up 2.5. March, 215 and 3/4, up 2. May corn, 223, up 1 and 3/4. December, 243 and a half, up 1 and a quarter.